Mr. Lee, reel 3.
Reposting. Do you, for God's sake, know anybody who could use an IOIB? To get that straight, that's a lieutenant, counterintelligence. Now, you've got to remember that when I said this, the only thing I knew about the organization behind this girl with thick glasses was that it was something to do with parachutes, cloaks and daggers, but the best thing of all was that they were reputed to have the most beautiful secretaries in any part of the British Army. I didn't know whether it was a civilian organization or a military one. I had no idea what it was apart from those three things. Parachutes, cloaks, daggers, there are four things, and beautiful secretaries. So she said, okay, I'll give you a ring if anything happens. This was in the morning, about 11 o'clock. I went back rather disconsolately to room 136, biting my nails down, wondering what on earth I was going to do. I couldn't bear the thought of being sent back to the depot. And at 3:30 that afternoon, my phone rang, and this was Elizabeth on the phone. She said, quick, can you come down to a chap just walked in, wringing his hands, saying that one of his captains got falling down drunk in the Barclay last night and told everybody what he was doing and said to be sent back to the depot, and he's desperately looking for another intelligence officer. So I mentioned your name to him, and he said, he'll see you. Can you come down? So I went down literally at the double. I just skipped down the stairs. No lifts in the War Office, not in those days. Went down and saw this chap. Turned out to be a man called Major E.C. Wetmore. Charming man. You know, when all through one's life, you meet people, men or women, and immediately there is a rapport immediately. Well, I felt I'd known him all my life. And we obviously clicked as people. I'm not a homosexual or anything like that. I don't run away with that, but there are some men that I like very much indeed, and we got on like a house on fire. And so I heaved a sigh of relief, and I thought maybe something will come of this. And I went back upstairs. I think I said earlier on that this was mid-March. I think it was much more likely to have been early April. And so I went back, so rather pleased with myself, thinking that there was a tiny chance of avoiding being sent back to the depot. So I went in to see the colonel, and I said I just had an interview, and he said, all right, well, good luck. I'm surprised if they'll take you on, repeated this business. And so I continued to do my work. And the days went by, and I heard nothing. Until about the end of April, I was summoned on to see Wetmore again. And I had another long talk with him, and he said, oh, I think probably be able to do something. And end of April turned up, and that was when I was going to be sent back to the depot unless I found another job. And I was really desperate. So I saw the colonel, and I said, look, I really think, sir, that things are moving in this organization that I've had an interview with. Do you think you could give me a little more time? And he said, rather reluctantly, he said he would. But it wasn't until the 23rd of April that I had my final interview with Wetmore. 23rd of May, that I had my final interview with Wetmore. And I was taken on. But prior to that, because there was this delay, because I realized now that my name was being put through the security index, and it took about 3 weeks in those days. I didn't know what was going on. But it must have been about the 15th of May or so. I rang up Marguerite Lepper, who was Major Wetmore's secretary. He'd given me this phone number to call. I didn't know where this was, but I just rang her up, and I got her on the phone. I said, look, I was a desperate thing. The colonel's really champing at the bit, trying to get rid of me. And am I or am I not going to be taken on? And she said to me, look, I really think you are. I think you have got the job. There were one or two formalities to be gone through. So I said, well, look, what on earth can I do? And she said, well, take 10 days' leave. Go in and tell your colonel that this organisation has given you 10 days' leave. So I did that, and I walked in. This girl, this beautiful blonde, she really was an absolute knockout. Just said everything, oh, take 10 days' leave. Things ought to be all right by then. Yes, it must have been about the 12th of May or something like that, because when I came back off leave, I was summoned up to Baker Street. And for the first time, I heard about 64 Baker Street. And I went there and to see Wetmore for the final interview. And then we had this... I walked into this place, which used to be something to do with... I think it was the headquarters of his... Of the prison officer's service in those days, heavily sandbagged entrance, and all very sort of what was the name of that Sherlock Holmes, all very Sherlock Holmes in Baker Street. And I walked into this building, went up into the attic of the building, and I found Wetmore, and Marguerite was there, and she showed me into his office in this attic. We had a lovely interview, and. And he said, well, okay, it's pretty well fixed now. So I said, well, so what will my job be? And he said, oh, I'll tell you that when you come, but you're just the sort of person we want. You'll be a sort of PA to me. So I went back to the War Office, and by that time they'd got a replacement for me because they knew that this was going to come off. And I spent 2 or 3 days handing over to this chap, and much more competent and qualified to do the job in MI-11 than I'd been. And on the 27th of May, Marguerite rang up to say, OK, you're in. And on the 2nd of June, I started at Baker Street. And the first thing that happened to me when I went to see Wetmore, he said, oh, by the way, you've only got 2 pips. This job carries 3 pips. And I found I was a captain. Well, that was lovely. So I became a GSO-IB, a GSO-3-IB. And so I then said, well, sir, can you tell me a little bit more about this organisation that I've joined? Is it ISRB or SOE? And he said, well, ISRB is merely the civilian cover name for SOE. And SOE is a word that you, a phrase that you must never, ever use or ever say, never mention it, not allowed to be mentioned. You're working in ISRB here.
What was ISRB supposed to have stood for?
ISRB was called Inter-Services Research Bureau. And the idea was that Inter-Services would allow, from a security point of view, allow officers of the three services in uniform to go in and out of the place without arousing any comment. And also it was possible for people in civilian clothes, male and female, to go in and out, because the research bureau, obviously, there would be civil servants there. Well, I discovered all sorts of interesting things. First of all, that my pay was going to be in cash, and there would be no tax, no income tax deducted. We were paid in sticky £5... No, they weren't. They were brand-new £5 notes. Those great big things about the size of an A4 piece of paper on white. It was absolutely marvellous. We used to go dashing off to the bank to stuff all this money into the bank every month because we never had really very much time to spend it, apart from going to the 400. Well, anyway, he told me that... he said, by the way, we've got 3 field security sections. That's 3 officers and 39 other ranks, and you're in charge of them. You've got to direct their activities. I said, well, what do they do? And he said, oh, well, I'm not sure, but you'll have to get to know all the country section people because these NCOs all speak an average of 3 languages each, and they go around on the courses, training courses, when they send all these agents around a 13-week course before they get dropped into various countries. So I said, which countries? He said, oh, well, we drop them in from Norway down to... Spanish Morocco, and we don't drop anybody into Spain at the moment because they haven't come in on our side yet, and we've got an office in Portugal and another one in Gibraltar. We drop them all over Europe, you know, and we've got a few in Italy and one or two in Germany. I couldn't believe this. I said, well, what else do we say? Well, we've got an office in Cairo that deals with the Balkans and Hungary and Romania and all those sort of countries, and Israel. No, Israel didn't exist then, was it? Palestine, that's right. Palestine and Turkey, and he said, I think we've got something going in the Far East as well, but it's all rather embryo. I blinked. I couldn't believe it. And I said, well, what do you actually do, Sam? He said, oh, well, we run all the sabotage. Churchill gave us a brief about a year ago. He said, set Europe ablaze, and that's what we're trying to do. He said, we're actually, you spend most of your time with European countries. And this is my introduction to SOE. It was quite unbelievable. Because I really, literally knew nothing about this organization until I joined it. He merely told me that, don't mention the fact that you come up to Baker Street for an interview. I just say you had an interview in the War Office. So I said, well, if I've been in the War Office for the last 6 months, I can't suddenly say I've come up to work for the Inter-Services Research Bureau. He said, no, you don't do anything like that. You just say you're in the War Office and you're with Special Training Schools headquarters. So I said, what's that? Oh, STS. Oh, we've got a room in the War Office there called STS headquarters. So if ever you have to do an interview, you always say you're coming, you're speaking from the War Office. And eventually we discovered that, I discovered that we had three telephone numbers altogether. We had direct links on the Abbey Exchange, which was the War Office. Where there was the STS headquarters number. We had another telephone number in Northumberland Avenue, which was a War Office building, where we carried out interviews, and that was on the Abbey Exchange. And then, of course, Baker Street was on the Welbeck Exchange for anybody who was seeing us on strictly civilian things and who thought that we really were working in ISRB. And to begin with, so whenever we had an incoming telephone call, the girls on the switchboard were under instructions to tell the officer concerned on what number the call had come through. So if it was Whitehall 1212, whatever the war office was, well, that's right, there was a Whitehall number and the Abbey number was Northumberland Avenue, I think. And Welbeck was Baker Street, that's right. So I'd be sitting in my office, for instance, after I got going, and telephone would ring, and the girl on the switch would say, there's a call for you on Whitehall 1212. And so I'd take it, and I would then have to immediately transfer my thoughts as though I was sitting in the War Office in the battle box and in Whitehall, and take this call. And very often it would be some chum of mine who was up in London on leave and knew I was in the War Office, and say, "Hello, boy, I'm up in London. Can we have lunch today?" So I'd say, "Where are you?" And I'm in that pub just at the top of Whitehall. He said, "It's 12:15. Should we meet in about 10 minutes' time? I just got to go to the loo." And yes, so come. Can we meet at 12:30? And here was I sitting in Baker Street. And so I said, well, look, I'm terribly sorry, but I'm right in the middle of a terribly important interview. I don't think I'll be free much before 1 o'clock, which gave me time to hop on a bus and get down to Whitehall and walk into the pub as though I'd just come round for the battle box. And, of course, all this was complicated because as our security arrangements got more detailed and one spent time talking to odd agents and things like that, and also to other people in the army, where we didn't want to know we didn't want them to know the real name of the person they'd talked to. I had three identity cards. Once there was my own official one. I was Captain Lee at the time, and then I also had another one which showed me as Captain Neville, working in Northumberland Avenue. And then I had another one, Captain Lowe, which showed me working in the War Office as a part of, came a bit later, MO1 in brackets SP, which was the War Office cover department, which I thought up with Colonel Charlie, who came down from Matlock to be my, to work with me, because it was no good those of us who weren't involved in training, saying that we were part of special training school headquarters, we had to have a War Office Department cover, so we cooked up this name, MO1SP, which didn't exist, and we had it put into the War Office telephone directory so that anybody who sort of got hold of it could knew that it really did exist. And of course, this number was another Whitehall number hooked up directly to Baker Street. And MO1SP we thought was terribly clever because we thought it stood for mysterious. We said it stood for mysterious operations in secret places, and we reckoned that the Germans, with their lack of sense of humour, would never be able to unravel that one. So that's how that cover story came up. But I've gone rather ahead of myself. When I first joined, the first thing I had to do was to get to know these three field security officers and the 39 NCOs. Well, of course, I didn't meet a lot of them for about 13 weeks because they were all out on training courses with the various nationalities that were being put through. Because at that time, I think when I joined SOE, we only had one or at most two agents in France, and I don't think we had a radio set working back. Jack de Galis had gone over and had already come back in the French section. I think he was dropped in, and I think he came out in a felucca. Can't remember. It's, the story, all these stories, operational stories, have been written up after the war. But
a felucca, an Egyptian boat.
No, felucca is a sort of fishing smack that operates in the Mediterranean. It's a Spanish fishing boat, Spanish type fishing boat. They used to go in by submarine or felucca or dropped in by parachute. But these were very, very early days in middle of 1941. And the chiefs of staff were getting really brassed off with SOE because they couldn't report any successes. The chiefs of staff, the military mind, simply didn't realize how difficult it was to get an organization like this off the ground. We were extremely unpopular because the regular army loathed anything to do with secret societies. All of us carried one rank above the rank we would normally have had in the orthodox services, because we had to be sufficiently senior to get our own way when we wanted something. We all carried, or a lot of us had, DR1 passes from MI5, which allowed us into all the sensitive, I think that's the euphemism they use now, all the sort of secret places. The whole of Arisaig, for instance, was a defence area, and nobody was allowed in unless you had a DR1 pass.
The whole of what?
Arisaig. That's it's that part of Scotland northwest of Fort William. It's where all the commando training was taking place, and where we had all our commando training schools for the agents. Again, coming back to June 41, I didn't know anything about this, so I had to start off by getting to know these men who were officially under my command. And to my horror, I discovered that they were, not only did they speak far more languages than I did, but they were, many of them were very highly qualified schoolmasters or barristers. And the luck of the draw when a war starts, it depends entirely on where you are and at what time and what happens as to whether or not you get a good or a bad job. And all these chaps had naturally gone into the intelligence corps because of their qualifications. But in the intelligence corps, the first thing they said to you was, well, your chances of getting promotion or becoming an officer are very slim, because we need qualifications like this in the other ranks, and the war establishments don't cater for too many officers. There are dozens of regular senior officers in the intelligence corps, and until they get knocked off, not much chance of the other ranks being promoted. They were all corporals or corporals and sergeants. We had no lance. The only lance corporal in an FS field security unit was the driver. the RASC driver, the field security officers were all lieutenants or captains, and there was one company sergeant major. So you had, there were 13 chaps altogether, the FSO, the company sergeant major, and 12 NCOs, and a driver. He didn't count. I found these chaps were billeted, and the only one I remember now is at Kingston, where we had a couple of houses, and but there must have been two other places where, because there were three sections, so each section would have had a house somewhere. But again, thinking back, it's so difficult to remember the details of this sort of thing. I met them all. I was terribly impressed with their qualities. They were people who, all individuals, who were absolutely reliable, as they had to be, because they would go off on these courses with a clutch of agents, and they'd be away for 13 weeks. And all they did was to send a weekly report in to me at Baker Street on how they were getting on. I'll come on to the detail of this in a minute. And I never saw them. And as soon as they came off, of course, they sent them on a week's leave, unless we were so pushed that we had to send them straight off on another course. They were wonderful men. We obviously had a few failures. And my first job was to sort out the ones that we got at the moment, because we'd had three. They weren't special sections that had been sent to us, although they were they were all NCOs who had to have certain languages. But they came to us as a bunch, and I had to sort them out into, find out the ones that really enjoyed the work and the ones that weren't really happy with it, who wanted something else to do. And I gradually replaced them by going down to the depot at Winchester, which had opened up by then, run where there was an awfully nice chap called Eric Wilkinson, I think his name was, who was in charge of all these NCOs. And I used to ring him up and say, look, I need a couple of Norwegians or Danes or Spaniards or Italians or whatever the language was that I needed. Can you rustle up a few people for me to interview? And he said, always give me a week or so, and I'll call you up, and I've got enough people to come for you to come. And I used to drive down to Winchester and interview these chaps. I take one of my sergeant majors with me, or whatever. I take one of the linguists who I already had to check that the man who was served up with interview had the language sufficiently fluently. Because I only spoke French, and I knew a bit of Spanish and German, but I couldn't speak it. And so I used to go down there and interview these people, and I gradually switched these 39 men round so that we had really specially selected NCOs. And I couldn't tell them what they were going to do. The only thing I could tell them was that it was quite voluntary, but on some of the work that they did involve parachute jumping on practice, not being dropped into on operations or anything like that, but it was the people who they would be with would be required to do parachute jumping and sort of commando type operations, because we had to sort of wrap it up as much as possible without giving anything away. And I had to be absolutely sure that these chaps that I took on could be trusted to do their job without supervision and be away from headquarters with nobody to help them for 13 weeks at a time, that they would be up against commandants of training schools who thought they were part of the Gestapo, because regular army officers, many of them saw their guardsmen who were running these guards officers who were running these training schools, very tough, intelligent people, but they were regular officers, and they had an almost paranoid dislike of anything to do with security, which they regarded as something to do with espionage and spies, and it was really not quite nice. What they didn't realize was that the counter-espionage side of SOE was almost a sort of branch of the Red Cross. We really had to try and make it possible for the agents to do their extremely dangerous work and come out of it alive. And the only way they could do that was to have a very, very keenly a developed sense of security, of not personal and physical security. And if they weren't alive to the... Are we running out of... They weren't alive to, almost like a woman's sixth sense, to things that had been said or something that didn't look quite right, they were bound to get caught. We had to be absolutely sure that when they were asleep and had a nightmare, that they didn't talk in their native language, whether it be English or, I'm supposing they were in France, and their first language was German and their second language was English, that they didn't wake up and suddenly start talking English.
How could you be sure of that?
Well, this is what my NCO's jobs was. These NCOs who went around the training courses, on these 13-week training courses, they lived with these agents all the time. And they used to stay awake and walk around and listen to anybody who was talking in their sleep and make quite sure that they were talking the language of the country that they were going to. Mind you, they were Frenchmen going to France, or they were Anglo-French going to France, but many of them spoke perfect English and also perfect French, and they thought in both languages. Could have been Dutchmen or Danes or Norwegians or Germans sometimes. And we were not allowed to recruit anybody for France who was pure French. They had to go to De Gaulle, unless they absolutely refused to work for the Free French Forces. But it was an edict that was laid down by Churchill and the Chiefs of Staffs, worked out with De Gaulle, that he did have first claim on pure Frenchmen.
Was anyone discarded because of this type of thing?
Oh, yes. Not only talking in your sleep and sort of waking up and suddenly talking English, but the other things that my chaps had to look for was how they handled money. Now, if you've got a garage mechanic who was an absolutely brilliant radio operator and was recruited for that job and was absolutely bilingual and fitted into the scenery and all that sort of stuff, and who'd had a very modest wage as a garage mechanic before the war, and was then dropped into France with £500,000 round his belt as the paymaster for the circuit. You had to be absolutely sure that that chap would not suddenly start going into expensive hotels and taking up beautiful girls and forgetting to clean his nails when he went into the most expensive restaurant in Paris, because he was liable to get picked up if he were. You had to be absolutely sure that they could handle money properly. You had to be absolutely sure, or you had to know exactly how they reacted when they had won over the eight. My NCOs used to spend as much time as possible with them, especially when they were on leave after the courses were over, to see how they behaved with women.
In what way?
Well, to see whether they were susceptible to women's charms, or whether they were able to keep away from women. Because after all intelligence services of any country use women as agents provocateurs. We've had all sorts of examples of that with the case.